afternoon. We're actually going to begin with a song. So if you could turn in your psalm books to 712. I was trying to think of songs that fit with the message of Ecclesiastes, and this one comes to mind because it's a groaning song, and Ecclesiastes does that. It cries out for a solution to the vanity of life. And this song does that too. And when you look in the New Testament in Romans 8, we talked about some of this a couple of weeks ago, the New Testament answers the call of Ecclesiastes. And like Paul in Romans 8 says, yeah, the creation's groaning. We're groaning, even though we've got the first fruits of the Spirit. But there's going to come a day when all of that finds resolution. The now but not yet idea is true. Like Mason was talking about during his really good lessons. But someday, the not yet will become the now. And we will find the satisfaction that we're looking for. So the morning is coming. The light is coming, even though we go through dark periods now. So that's what this song's about. That's what Ecclesiastes is about. And so we'll tie those two together and we'll sing this here. 712. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, if you could be turning there in your Bibles. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And before we get into the text, let's approach the Father who gave us this text and thank Him for our day in this time. Our great and wonderful God, we know that it is only by your grace and your mercy and your tremendous love that we exist, that we have our being, that we enjoy the blessings that you've given us in this life. We know that it is by your grace that we are here at this moment. opening these books that you have given to us, talking about a single book of this book and its significance for our lives. We are thankful for all of these good things. We are thankful for your Son. We are thankful for each other and for the mutual encouragement and upbuilding that we get from each other as believers. We are thankful for the sacrifice that this book looks forward to, the resolution of the vanity of this world in the person of your Son. We're thankful that he chose freely to take on the pain of darkness, the vanity of this life, and we're thankful that we find our hope now in him and what he has done. As we look backward into time, at this book of Ecclesiastes, before your Son was known about, we pray that you open our minds and hearts and that we would receive these teachings in the way that you intend, and that you be with us in our lives, that we would bring glory to you, for we understand that to fear you and to keep your commandments is the whole reason why we are here during this time, in this place. Help us to do that. In Jesus we pray, amen. All right, so a couple weeks ago, we did chapter one, we did some intro stuff. From chapter one, what do you remember about how the book opens up? What is the basic idea that runs through chapter one? I mean, the basic thought is vanity, vanity is all vanity, which we talked about as, you know, vanity means a vapor or a mere breath, something that you can kind of see, but you can't really grasp or hold on to. That's kind of like what life is. James talks about that in the New Testament, etc. But what is the train of thought then that backs up his claim in chapter one that everything's just vanity? Nothing really changes. Everything just kind of runs around in a circle. You know, the sun, you know, starts over here, ends over there, every day. Water does the same thing. Got the water cycle. You got the wind. Here it's over here. Now it's over there. You can never grab hold of it. It's just everywhere. Generation comes, generation goes. You know, you mow your lawn on a Saturday, and guess what? Next Saturday rolls around, and you're going to need to mow your lawn again. After we get done here, during this hour, I'm going to go home, I'm going to help Jenny get dinner on the table, and then we're going to wash dishes. I don't like washing dishes, but we need to do it, because that's what you do after you make dishes dirty, and tomorrow we're going to make dinner, and guess what? We're going to do the same thing again, and same thing again, and same thing again. That's just the nature of life, and so this has helped me. Books like this help me, because in the moments when you're doing the maintenance that just seems to go on forever, or, you know, you're doing stuff that you'd rather not do, you're like, well, this is kind of the nature of life right now. It's not always going to be the way life is. Someday, our work in heaven is going to be different from this life, but that is the way we should think about it right now. It's just a temporary arrangement, but that is what it is. And so that is going to lead us now into chapter two. So he said... sorry, did I miss something? Everybody have a comment? Okay, I thought I heard somebody say something. But any comments or questions before we get into chapter two? Okay. So he said at the end of chapter one that he is applying his heart to know wisdom, madness, and folly. And I don't think that means he's holding up madness and folly as equally viable options to wisdom. He's not saying, yeah, they're all equal. He's just saying, I want to flip over the coin, and I want to see both sides of the coin, and I want to investigate everything. But he's going to tell us that wisdom is worth it. So he's going to do some testing. And he's going to tell us about the kinds of tests that he runs in chapter 2. And the first one is in 1 through 11. So can I get a volunteer to read 1 through 11 for us? Okay, Steve, thank you.
I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it too was futility. I Instead of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body, and with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there was for the sons of God to do under heaven for the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had fur homeborn slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold, the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers, and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and all the labor which I had exerted. Behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun.
Okay, so this experiment, how would you sum up this experiment that he's running, that he tells us about in 1 through 11?
Try it all. Got rid of
everybody. Yeah. Right. Right. He's just going to go on a let's pleasure myself binge. Now, he's going to do it. He's going to try to do it in a wise way with moderation. I mean, he says, I think he says that in verse 3 with the wine. My heart was still guiding me with wisdom as I'm trying to lay hold on all these things. But I'm just going to increase what I have, the quantity of what I have, in order to try to find ultimate meaning. And that's what a lot of people try to do to find meaning is, and that might seem logical at first, like if you're hungry and you eat some, you know, piece of cheese or something, and you're still hungry, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to go to the fridge, you're going to go to the, you know, the fruit basket, and you're going to eat a banana. You're going to eat something else. You're going to increase the intake for your body until the point at which you say, okay, now I'm not hungry anymore. I'm good. I'm satisfied. But that doesn't work in the long run, right? Because even though you get full on one meal, another meal rolls around and you get hungry again, and you get hungry again. And so we don't find ultimate meaning in that kind of way. But people do that with money too, right? Well, I'm gonna increase my bank account. I'm gonna get a better job. I'm gonna get a fancier car. I'm gonna get a nicer, bigger house, and that is gonna be the point at which I'm satisfied. But if you read interviews that billionaires do, often they will talk about how they're trying to chase the next buck, the next thing, the next project to increase their holdings. And so, really, it's never enough, and that's where the preacher is to probably Solomon, is he's telling us that is a dead end. He had access to everything, he explored it all, but he still found that the road just went on and on forever. So before we spend our lives trying to run down this road, he's going to try to tell us, well, that's where it leads. And I think this is interesting because I think this book, I strongly suspect that this book is geared toward young people, because the way that the book ends in chapter 12 is, and this is one of the memory verses that my parents had me memorize as a kid, in chapter 12, verse 1, remember also your Creator when? In the days of your youth, before the years come, the days draw near, which you will say, I have no pleasure in them, before all things happen that chapter 12 talks about, get your head right while you're young and get a good perspective on your life and what it's for so that you don't chase these things that don't add ultimate meaning to your life. So he's back here in chapter 2, he's really starting to lay this out. And so he tested a lot of different things in order to delight himself. What are some of the things that he tests?
Wine, women, and song.
Yeah, pretty much. That's one of the ways that the world just keeps going around and around, is every generation comes on the scene, and we're like, oh, we got to try this. And the Bible just lays this out and says, yeah, people tried that before. And you can't break that cycle. So, yeah, to put it bluntly in verse 3, he tried drugs. He did. And since ancient times, people have been trying to use the various substances that grow in the ground or you can find somewhere in the earth in order to give us some sort of transcendent experience in the form of something to smoke or drink or inject. And his drug of choice was alcohol. And like I said earlier, he experimented in moderation, verse 3. Also in verse 9, did you notice in verse 9, he'll say it again, that also my wisdom remained with me. So he didn't leave that behind in all these tests that he ran. He tried to maintain that, but he did search out everything that there was to search out. So he tried something to give him an alternate state of mind. And he says, that didn't really do it. Verse 8, skipping down there, he's trying sexual relationships toward the middle to end of that. And notice how he says, after he said he got singers, men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of men. If we're talking about Solomon here, how many women did Solomon have? Yeah, he got 700 wives and 300 concubines, 1 Kings 11. But even if this isn't Solomon, it isn't pretty common in the ancient world for kings to have a lot of women. David had a lot of women, definitely not as many as his son did, but Saul had multiple women as well. There's just the way that kings ran their households, usually. But it's interesting, if this is Solomon, then I think the Proverbs indicate that his wives caused him about as much pain as they as they did pleasure, because he'll say in the Proverbs, like Proverbs 21, verse 9, verse 19, 27, 15, it's better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. Solomon attached himself to a lot of women who didn't care about God. And so I think he wrote about that then in the Proverbs. Here he says, I tried all of that, and that didn't make me find ultimate meaning. What about verses 4 through 6? What did he do there? What did he test there?
Nature.
Yeah, he tried to make beautiful scenery. He tried building things. He tried working hard, designing buildings and pavilions and gardens and beautiful stuff. And we know from Solomon's life, what did he build? The two things that he's really famous for, one of them was the God's house. And he was 7 years in building the temple. He also built a really big palace for himself. He was 13 years building that house, and we're told a little bit about that in the book of Kings. So he tried hard to do that. He says here he grew these luscious landscapes that must have been really great, because verse 5, I planted myself, made myself gardens and parks, and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees, and made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Kind of reminds me of the Garden of Eden, where we're told in Genesis there are a bunch of fruit trees there, there's a bunch of water and rivers there to water all those trees. Really, really neat pictures that we see here, but that didn't really do it either. Verses 7 and 8, he worked to acquire possessions, so he collected people. He got slaves of both genders. Some of them were bought, he says, and some of them, he had so many and they were marrying each other that some slaves were just born into his household, so he had plenty of labor to go around. He had servants, he had entertainers of both genders, he says. He had concubines, he collected animals, he had flocks and herds, which in their day was one of the main ways that you measured wealth. It wasn't, well, what is your bank account number at Bank of America? It's, you know, how many animals you got out there in the field. So he collected that. He collected silver and gold. Huge, huge theme in Solomon's narrative in Kings. In fact, I think, I didn't write this down, but I think there's a passage that talks about how silver was just counted as nothing during the days of Solomon. Yeah, just it was like rocks on the ground. You know, you pick, oh, that's just silver. So, you know, he collected a lot of wealth. I mean, and he, verse 9, how did he do with that? What did he become in verse 9? Yeah, I became great, and I surpassed everybody who was before me in Jerusalem. And he enjoyed a lot of the parts of this process. Verse 10, he said, I kept my heart from all pleasure, and my heart found pleasure in all my toil. This was my reward for all my toil. So he had fun doing this, but verse 11, he comes down in the conclusion and says, well, it didn't give me ultimate meaning. By the way, did you notice who he does all these things for? Did you notice the repetition of the language of...
I'm made for myself.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And because he's doing this test for himself, and we're just not designed to live only for ourselves. So yeah, it's going to be vanity if you are just trying to grab for you. What about other people? We're designed as God's tools to be blessings to the nations, blessings to the other people around us. And this is just not part of his test. So it's going to be vain. All right. Comments or questions on this so far from 1 through 11? Anybody wants to add to any of this? Okay. 12 through 17. Can somebody read that for us? Brent, thank you.
So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that some of the same events happen to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this is also vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies is just like the fool. So I hated life because what it had done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity.
Okay, thank you. So what is this test about? What's he trying to do here?
You all end up in the same place. So pushing and fighting and trying to amass everything that you possibly can isn't going to make you good in the end.
Yeah. So he's going to get to, you know, we're all going to die. He's going to talk about that. And in verse 12... he's going to say, I'm turning to think about wisdom and madness and folly, which back in 117, he says, that's where I'm going with all this too. If you look at also verse 3, I mean, verse 3 gets at that as well. My heart's guiding me with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the few days of life. But his conclusion is, well, wisdom as an ultimate goal is also vanity as well, because, like what Brent said, the wise guy, and I mean that in the best senses, the wise person dies just like the fool does. And so each new generation comes along and, you know, each generation says, well, I'm going to be wiser than my parents were because I know a bunch more stuff than they do. Well, you know, every generation kind of thinks that way. I'm more progressive than they are. But each generation grapples with the fact that this is just this is the way that life is. No generation can be wise enough to escape the vanity. So if wisdom is just striving after wind, what should we just live it up and just not care and just be whoever we want to be with no guardrails? What does he say about that? Yes. So I, you know, this is real. This is one of those moments in Ecclesiastes where we have to really make sure that we're seeing everything that he's saying here, because if you read his book, you know, he's not wanting you to come away with, well, then I should just not care about life, and I should just give up, and I should just, you know, not try hard to be a God-fearing person. That's not at all what he wants us to take away from this, because he's going to say, well, but wisdom is good. Wisdom is really good. Wisdom is like light versus darkness. If you have light in the room as opposed to darkness, you know, you can see. I like the way that the ESV words this, that the wise person has eyes in his head. He's got this gain, but the fool just can't see where he's going. And so wisdom is good. He's encouraging us to have wisdom. He's not downplaying it. He's just saying if you try to become wise thinking that that is the existence of life, that's where it's all about, then you're going to be disappointed because eventually you're going to lose your life just like everybody else does. And the fool dies as much as the wise man does. But he's trying to balance what he's saying there. Because he also says about wisdom, you know, it can't save our name from being forgotten by future generations. Verse 16, for as the wise as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. But, you know, in the Proverbs, you have Proverbs like Proverbs 10:7, which say, if Solomon's the one that wrote Ecclesiastes. Solomon's the one who wrote Proverbs, and he says there that in Proverbs 10:7, the memory of the righteous will be a blessing, but the name of the wicked will rot. And there is a sense in which that is true. Righteous people are remembered several generations after they die, right? I'll give one example. Anybody know a guy by the name of Leslie Disselkamp? Okay, some of you did know him. I never knew him personally. I would have loved to have met him and talked with him about the gospel and about his experiences and life. I never got that chance, but I know of him. I know his name. I've read his articles. I've even listened to some of his lessons that were recorded. Jenny's memory of him is pretty hazy. But there are so many people around the Midwest and even other parts of the country and maybe even the world that still know of him and are still being encouraged by the work that he did, even though he died in, I think Jenny said when I asked her today, I think he died in the mid-90s. So we're going on like 30 years where Brother Disselkamp has been in his grave. But his work is still going on. So the memory of the righteous does continue, but yes, eventually, you know, if the earth goes long enough, eventually Ecclesiastes picks up and says, but, you know, you're not going to be remembered. But this is where we need to remember God, because who is going to remember your name? Even if your name fades off of the tombstone, who's going to remember your name? Yeah. Because God has, as he tells us several times, he has what? He has a book of life, or the book of the Lamb. It's called Revelation. And it's got the record of all of his people in it. And so, day of judgment comes, and we're not going to be standing in front of God, and he says, what was your name again? Like, okay, maybe I know you. He's going to know us. because we're his kids. Do you ever forget the names of your kids? I forget the you know, which kid goes with which name sometimes. Lydia, Tessa, Isaiah, so, okay, you know, but we never forget our kids, truly. So that's the way it is with God. And we are known by him now. We're going to be known by him later. And so this message needs to be put beside the other teachings of Scripture. Otherwise, we're going to get skewed in how we're looking at this. Comments or questions through verse 17? Yes, sir.
Here's a man with all the wisdom. He asked for it and got it. So he knows, you know, we just went through these verses, that at the end, whether you're wise or foolish, you're in the same. Mm-hmm. You leave with nothing.
Right.
So yet here we have him continually searching for something that isn't there, but he doesn't know if it's there until he tries it. Well, look at us today. Mm-hmm. You know, parents try to teach their kids, don't touch the hot stove. And the kids got to touch it before they learn.
Right.
I mean, we're doing the exact same thing, even though we have Solomon telling us these things. We have the other testaments telling us these things. They all come from God, but we have trouble placing our full faith and confidence in his word. So we have to go out and sample for ourselves. And if we look at the way, for instance, we grew up not in the church, mm-hmm. versus the children that had grown up within the church, our backgrounds are completely different. Until we all come to the realization of the truth, which is Christ is our Savior, and give ourselves over to him, back to God. But then, are we satisfied with what we have, or do we still have to go out in search of those things? Which is what we're talking about. Even
right.
though we have
right.
generation after generation explaining to us the Father.
Yes. So this is our opportunity to learn the lesson on the cheap, you know, rather than the hard way, where you get knocked in the head the same way everybody gets knocked in the head if they go that route. Yeah, this is why we have this book and the other parts of the Scriptures, is God's trying to steer us in the right direction so that we can be fully useful for him in the time that we have under the sun, and then go home to glory and be useful to him there in whatever we're going to be doing there. The what's there?
The curiosity.
Yes.
Which leads us sometimes astray.
Yeah, boy, that fruit looks really good. I know he said we shouldn't eat it, but man, that's
and
juicy then looking.
Says, oh, shall surely not.
Right.
You shall be as God.
Right.
Those are very impressive words.
Right.
Better right enthusiasts than the one that God blessed with every possible thing.
I know. Yeah, especially if you just try to gain it for yourself. If you gain it and then you use it for helping other people, there's a whole lot more blessing in that than just, you know, doing what he does here. Good. Other comments or questions so far? All right. Well, let's finish up the chapter and then call it a day. 18 through 26. Who's got that? Who wants to read that? Toby, thank you.
I hated all my toil, in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled, and use my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it.
Okay, so remember back in verse 10, he said, in all the stuff that I did, I found some pleasure in all my toil. But then here in verse 18, he says, well, but I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. So he's going through the roller coaster of emotions here. On the one hand, he's finding some fun and some satisfaction, but if he's trying to use that as his ultimate meaning of life, that's where verse 18 comes into play. So it might, like we talked about during the intro class, it might seem like he's being bipolar here, but he's got a purpose here that he's trying to drive us to. So he looks at his work, and he says, well, that's vanity too, because you don't get to keep what you've worked so hard to achieve. And you think about the way our society runs. We've got retirement accounts, we've got savings accounts, we've got ways to develop a financial cushion, but there's really not a promise from God that you're going to live to 90 and that you're never going to have aches and pains and that everything's going to go well for you and all of that. So that's important to understand, because when the aches and pains come, and I know they're coming for me just like they come for everybody, you know, I have to have the right attitude about that and be like, how could God let me suffer X, Y, and Z? I can't believe that. Well, it's life under the sun, and a lot of our lives are going to have some discomfort to them. And we can even check the news, and every now and then we're reading about some young, rich, famous person who had it all, and yet, you know, they die of cancer in their 40s or 50s or something like that. So there's not a guarantee about enjoying wealth. And even if you do, you're going to give it to the next person. And he also mentions here, verse 19, how about that next person? Is he going to be a wise person, or is he going to be a foolish person? You don't really have control over that. And if we're talking about Solomon as the preacher here, who did Solomon leave all of his riches and glory to? Rehoboam. What kind of guy was Rehoboam? What is Rehoboam known for? Rehoboam did some stuff, but what is he known for?
Taking the advice of the young people.
Yeah.
Splitting everything up and making it far worse than it was before.
Yes. I mean, he squandered his golden opportunity. The people came to him and said, we'd like to serve you, but we have one stipulation. Can you just be easier on us than your dad was? I mean, because he was brutal. And Rehoboam comes back and says, you think my daddy was tough? I'm going to be that much tougher. And they're like, well, see you later. We're done with the house of David. We're going to start our own country because you're a doofus. I have to wonder if this is Solomon writing this, if he could see Rehoboam in the next room and be like, oh, man. I'll limit it to this guy. But regardless, you know, this is just a truism of life, that you have no control over what happens to what you have done in the next generation. And so those things are hard to grapple with. Verse 22, verse 23, this is kind of a low dip in the roller coaster that he's riding. You know, work is hard because of Adam's curse, and it's going to be hard. We know until Jesus sets creation free and our bodies free and the resurrection comes. But sometimes even the moments of rest that we have aren't really that restful. But in the midst of expressing this frustration, what does he encourage us to do? And it's one of those times in the book where we've got to see the upward motion of the roller coaster. What is he encouraging us to go for here? Yeah. I mean, for the moments of your life when you find pleasure, you find satisfaction, you can be around your kitchen table with your family, you can be with your brethren, in worship or in study, or you can do something that brings you some level of satisfaction. Enjoy those moments, because those are a gift given to you from God. This life is not all gloom and doom. It's not. Even though you might look at places in this book and think, well, this is such a downer, this he is offering us a perspective here. Also, I love verse 26, where he says, "For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God." Isn't that interesting verse? So just as a maybe a silly example of this, have you ever thought about, you know, the hours and hours and hours of engineering that goes into making a device like the Apple iPad? I mean, people over in Cupertino, California, at the Apple spaceship thing, they spend their lives and countless sleepless nights poring over how to make things and products that people are going to buy and enjoy and keep buying. But you know, for those of us here, you know, I didn't make this. I didn't spend any hours making this at all. But I can just go to Amazon and I can click a button and I can get this in the mail, and I can put my Bible software on here, and I can put my teaching notes on here, and I can use this for God's glory. I think that is kind of what verse 26 is getting at. The sinner spends his life on a hamster wheel trying to run around and collect the wisdom, collect the knowledge, collect the ways of making things in the way they're supposed to be. But guess where that goes? It goes into the hands of people of God who then use that for good. I think that's just such a neat idea. And there are actually other places in the Bible that talk about this. I think there's some Isaiah passages that get at this as well. But this is vanity and striving after wind for the sinner. But there's some satisfaction here for the person of God, who can use these things for him. Comments or questions on all this before we start to wrap things up? Well, I appreciate everybody's attention to the words of God here and coming here this afternoon. We will be having a class next week, but it's not going to be Ecclesiastes. I'm going to be taking a really short trip to Elmira, New York for a Bible study. And so Steve has graciously agreed to fill in. He's going to be doing something other than Ecclesiastes. So you can keep reading forward here to be prepared for this class, but next week there'll be something different, and I appreciate you doing that for me. Any more things we need to mention before we dismiss for the night?
If anybody wants to spread the word for next week, I think we're going to study about generational divisions that are occurring in the Church of Christ.
Ooh, can you record that? Can we record that? Because I want to be here for that, but I won't be. All right. Thank you. We're going to wrap it up there, and hope you all have a wonderful evening. Thanks.